From Buck's studio at Wisconsin Public Radio, this is Zorba Pastor on Your Health. I'm Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor, here to talk with you about what's new in healthy living, share some down-to-earth advice, and some great lifestyle tips to help you get the most out of life. If you have a question for Zorba, here is the number to call, 1-800-462-7413. And along with your call, Zorba, some topics to talk over.
Yes, free samples in doctors' prescriptions and how they influence us. Notice that I am included in the us.
Okay, and?
And we're going to talk about house calls, but a very specific type of house calls that seem to be making a comeback and are actually reimbursed by people such as Medicare.
Doctor house calls?
Yeah, doctor house calls.
800-462-7413. But before our first call, our recipe.
Yes, Thai summer rolls.
And that's a guest recipe that's coming up in, 25 minutes or so. Let's get to the phones now, Zorba. We welcome our first caller, a listener in Racine, Wisconsin. Hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I switched from drinking regular milk to soy milk to almond milk, and I found when I drink a glass of chocolate almond milk at night, I have the most bizarre dreams that I've ever had in my life, to the point where they just seem, nothing makes sense in them. I don't know the people. They're very trippy dreams is the best word I can describe. And is there some difference between almond and soy milk? What is causing these crazy dreams?
Now, can I ask about the dreams? Are they pleasant dreams? Are they scary?
No. They don't make sense at all. They're people I don't know. They're places I've never been. They're not violent dreams, but they make no sense at all. And I don't get much sleep as it is, so I rarely get to the dream stage. But I seem to do it when I have this almond milk. Only chocolate.
Chocolate almond milk. Okay, I just want to get this straight. So not, well, I'm not exactly sure why. I don't think it's the almonds that are doing it. It wouldn't make sense. Almonds don't make people sort of sleepy and dreamy. But let's go into what you're actually drinking. Okay, so you're drinking chocolate. So the chocolate part is a syrup. You put it in the milk or do you buy it as chocolate almond milk?
It comes like that.
Okay.
So by dark or light.
So when you're getting almond milk, you're getting a highly industrialized manufactured food. That's what you're getting. When you're getting milk, it's from the cow. And what goes into the milk is basically they pasteurize the milk. Mm-hmm. They homogenize the milk, which basically puts the fat into the milk. If you have skim milk, they just take all the fat out of it. So they mix up the milk to make sure you don't have fat droplets and cream on the top. And that's it. And then if you have chocolate milk, if it's chocolate, they put in chocolate syrup, like Hershey syrup. It's an industrialized product, but it's fairly close to being natural. There's not a lot that's often done with chocolate syrup. With almonds, they take the almond and they do whatever they do. They have to pulp it down. They have to pulverize it. They have to move it around. They have to make it seem like a natural product. Now, there is nothing in nature in almond of milk. Now, coconut, for instance, as something is natural, but there's nothing natural about almond milk, but it has a feeling that it's kind of natural.
Yeah, well, that's all really interesting information, but what's it got to do with dreams?
Because I don't know what they put into it. In other words, there may be something in the manufacturing process
that would cause dreams?
Well, there may be something that is affecting your sleep that they're doing. I don't know what chemicals they use at it. I don't know what preservatives they use in it. I don't know what they use to make it color. They may put in coloring. Read that label.
So
there's stuff in that milk that may be causing this. So, for instance, when I have sausage, and I have been known to eat sausage because I happen to love it, if I eat it around lunch, I find that 2 o'clock in the afternoon, I feel really tired. Well, I finally figured out. It's not just the salt, because sausage happens to have salt. It's the nitrates and nitrites that are in there. If I don't have sausage at lunch, I don't really get as tired at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. So there's something in the industrialized food that does it, there may be something in the soy milk or the almond milk that's actually doing it. Does it happen with soy milk? You said it does not.
No, it doesn't.
Okay. Now, I'll give you one more thing. Why did you give up regular milk? You live in Wisconsin. How could you possibly give up milk in our state? It's against the law to give up milk.
It causes too much mucus, and I have to blow my nose too much, and I tend towards nosebleeds from blowing it too much, so I gave up.
Well, then I would go, I would not use chocolate almond milk at bedtime. I would use soy milk. And I would just assume that. The other thing you can do, by the way, is try different manufacturers of chocolate almond milk. And a perfect example would be yogurt. If you get, we'll say, vanilla yogurt, and you try different types of yogurt, they taste different. Greek yogurt tastes different than, we'll say, Danone yogurt, which tastes different than generic, Surefine, artificially flavored yogurt. In other words, so there are differences in how they manufacture yogurt. There are differences in how they manufacture almond milk. Try a different kind if you like almond milk.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Appreciate the call. Thank you. So, Zorba, free samples given out by doctors would have some effect on the doctor's prescription.
Absolutely. So, full disclosure.
Yeah. Okay.
First of all, we used to give out free samples in our clinic, and we got lunches from the detail people. We got dinners from the detail people who came in. We got free samples, and we said, well, this doesn't influence our sampling at all, you know, because we're good doctors and we're not going to be influenced. And then our group, and also I went and I spoke. I've spoken for drug companies in the past, and I've gone to other doctors' office, and I've talked to them about new drugs that I have. The drugs that I've actually tested 90% of the time. And those are always whenever we go and whenever we would go to speak. And I got reimbursed, would speak at doctor's offices. They would leave free samples. So I was influenced. I was an influencer. Now, about 10 years ago, maybe even longer, we kicked the detail people, that's what we called them, the sampler people, out of the office because our group said, let's do an experiment. So for a year, we did an experiment of how our prescribing was influenced. We got them out of the office. We have an HMO. Half our practice is an HMO. And then we looked at the number of name brand drugs versus generic drugs. And you know what? Even if you don't think they influence you, they end up influencing you. So I'll give you a perfect example. This is a study that was reported all over the country. These were adult acne medications. They're very good acne medications that are generic. These are where academic centers, okay? Academic centers. Again. Universities, great doctors, know what they're doing, young doctors. 17% of the prescriptions for adult acne medications were for brand names. Far fewer than the 79% prescribed in private practice, which were for brand names. So in private practice, 80% of the docs, of the dermatologists, were giving brand name medications. In academic institutions, it was about 20% of the docs.
When the brand names would not be significantly
different than the academic practices that they looked at, they did not have samples. And what happens is, and I remember when we used to get dermatology samples, is we would get a bunch of small little, we'd get small little tubes of what it was, and we would hand it to people and we'd say, well, try this out and see if it works. And if it works, we would then give a prescription. They'd call us back or we would give the prescription. Well, you never have samples for generics, except in our practice. 10 years ago, for about 5 to 7 years, we decided that we would have generic samples and pay for them through our HMO. So when you came in for certain drugs, not for dermatological prescriptions, if you came in and you needed a blood pressure pill, we had a generic blood pressure pill sample that you would we would give you free of charge. And that ended up changing our prescribing patients and saving patients money. Now, our motivation for paying for this turned out to be the HMO side of the practice, which is trying to cut down on brand name drugs. Yes. Do you follow me?
I do, sure.
So in other words, there actually was a business model within our group that was worthwhile. Now, since that time, full disclosure, I no longer we no longer give samples, and I've learned that I should the only drugs that I should speak for would be drugs that I feel are new and highly innovative for which there is no generic.
So, if I'm a patient and my doc gives me a free sample, I should be a little bit suspicious.
Well, no, I think you should say, "Is there a generic?" No, I don't think you should be suspicious. If you get a free sample from your doctor and you get a prescription, what you want to say is there a generic alternative or equivalent?
So, first of all, if it's a
free sample of a drug, it means the drug is branded. Okay, so there's no generic equivalent, but there may be a drug that is similar. And that's the question. Is there a drug that's similar? Now, if you go to the pharmacy, let's say you don't want to ask the doctor. You don't want to sort of say, well, I'm not sure about this. Mm-hmm. You go to the pharmacy. You ask the pharmacist before you get it filled, is there a drug like this? The pharmacist will tell you. And if the answer is yes, have the pharmacist call the doctor's office and say, so-and-so does not want to pay for the name brand. This generic is similar. Can we use it? I will predict that 95% of the time the answer is yes, mm-hmm. because the physician is not aware of the difference. One more example. Often an acne tube of a branded medication might cost $20, or $100 rather, and a generic drug that is similar may cost
$25. Right. Interesting.
Yes.
800-462-7413 to Brookfield, Wisconsin we go now. Hi.
Hi, Tom. Dr. Zorba, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I am calling regarding my grandson. He was born November 3rd of just this last year. He's just a baby. In the first month or two, my daughter noticed that his head would be always cocked to the left side, no matter what when she was holding him, feeding him, laying on the floor in bed. So at 2 months of age, she talked to her doctor. I urged her to, you know, I said, if anything's bothering you, just talk to your doctor. So she did, and they suggested moving his position in his bed so that when he's sleeping, he's not always putting his head in the same way, and so that, you know, there, at least he was moving around. So after 2 months, it really didn't seem to be doing any, it wasn't making the neck any better. It was still cocked to the left. So then at 4 months, she asked the doctor the same thing, and they suggested to do like a neck stretching exercise where they, you know, every time you change the baby's diaper, you know, move his head and whatever kind of exercise they asked her to do, it still didn't seem to be doing anything. And she said, and I live here, but she lives in Arizona, so I don't see him on a regular basis. She said, if you saw him all the time, you would see that his head is always to the left.
Mm-hmm.
So she's still concerned.
Oh, sure. She should be concerned. There's a good reason to be concerned. Now, has she gone to physical therapy or occupational therapy with her child?
She has an appointment coming up with a doctor or a clinic to mm-hmm. see if he's a candidate for what's called headbanding.
Mm-hmm. Well, the first step, first of all, is his head developing differently itself? His head may be developing differently from the way he's in the crib, because sometimes that's an issue.
Do you mean like size?
Mm-hmm. Size and the way the head is, so he doesn't have a funny-looking head. I mean, and when I say funny, I don't mean that in a derogatory way,
mm-hmm.
but he doesn't have a head that looks abnormal and looks, you know, sort of top-heavy, because the skull develops while the child is a year and 2 years of age, and then it fuses. And so sometimes if a child is laying in a funny position, the skull itself will start to develop in a different way, and so their head will look strange and unusual. And that may be one of the things that they're looking at. I'm not sure, but when you say headbanding, that's what I think of.
Mm-hmm.
If she has only received exercises at the office and the physician said, do this and do that, I don't think it's enough.
Okay.
She has to go to a physical therapy or occupational therapist who specializes in this. In other words, there are OTs and PTs who actually do range of motion exercises with kids and will show her how to do that at home. And
okay.
that may be part of it. It may be that he's got muscle shortening and, you know, and this is very useful. The other issue is some kids actually have tics, even at this young age, and they begin to tick. They automatically, it's unusual, will turn their head on one side, and then it feels comfortable, and they do it again and again and again, in which case a neurologist really has to be involved. That is a possibility too. But I think at this age, the first step I would do is say, you need to go to a physical therapist, and the doctor has to find out who a physical therapist in town is that will do the range of motion exercises that are necessary so that the neck develops appropriately and the neck muscles develop appropriately. But I think that's different. I'm not exactly sure, but it sounds to me different from the headbanding. I have a question. You live where?
I'm in Wisconsin.
And she lives where?
Mesa, Arizona.
So you live far away from her. And
yeah.
When was the last time you saw her and the baby?
I went out right after he was born.
And the baby is now how many months old?
Well, he'll be almost 6 months.
Uh-huh.
And I've seen a lot of pictures.
You know what you need to do, Mom? I think you need to have a visit to your daughter and go down there and eyeball the baby yourself. That's what you need.
I actually do have a trip planned.
That's what you need. There's nothing like eyeballing the situation, giving her a second hand. Doing it over the phone might be okay. Saying this or saying that, there's nothing like a hug and a glance and an advocate. You need to go down there, go with her to the doctor, go with her to the surgeon, go with her to the physical therapist. This is one of those family QFTs, quality family time. That's really going to pay off. So you sound like you're a great advocate. You got to get down there and help her. Besides, she's your baby.
She is. She's my baby. So doctor's orders, I have to take a trip.
Absolutely. And if you need an FLMA leave of absence, you just call the station and I'll take care of it.
You write me a note, doctor.
You got it, baby. I'll do it.
Sounds great. Thank you so much
for
your help.
Sure. Thanks a lot for the call. We appreciate it. And before we take a quick break, Zorba, let's log into the Zorba Pastor on Your Health inbox and tackle a listener question. Dear Dr. Zorba and Tom, I'm wondering what you know about irritable bowel syndrome. I've done a lot of research, and it is very complicated. The literature always mentions getting enough fiber, but I find that whole wheat and oatmeal bother me. I avoid all the common triggers like beans and cauliflower, but I think things that are supposed to be good like almonds and grapes bother me as well. Do you know of a reset diet that would put me back to zero so I can add foods back to try to determine exactly what bothers me? Thanks for your help.
Wish that there were a reset diet because it really doesn't exist. Irritable bowel syndrome is a great big, if you will, umbrella for a bunch of things, some of which we understand and some of which we don't. Mm-hmm. We know smoking, alcohol are bad for it. We know that for a lot of people it might be beans. For some people it might be a little wheat intolerance or a little milk intolerance. But for a lot of people it's just an overactive bowel and it's alternating
diarrhea. So like our listener says, it is complicated.
It's very complicated because, frankly, we don't know what causes it. So what you have to do is eliminate one thing after another. You have to have a clinician who will help you with this because there are a number of drugs that can help. Medications that you take after meal, a drug called Levsin, L-E-V-S-I-N, comes to mind. An old drug called Bentyl, B-E-N-T-Y-L, comes to mind. Fiber can be useful for many people, but not for all people. Mm-hmm. So she's discovered fiber doesn't work. But it's very complex because it's not one cause. And if we could reset the body, I would love it.
Wouldn't that be great?
And you know what? I want to reset my body to 25. That's what I want to do. And even if it were a day, that would be really, really great. 25, no aches, no pains, no injuries, nothing.
Yep.
With my brain. I want my brain at this age, but I want to be 25.
I'll take my brain at 25 compared to this age. Would you like Zorba to help you digest some health information? Post your question to our Facebook page or send it along in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
We have a guest chef recipe coming up. Really, really going to be good. Lots more of your calls, some more interesting research to talk over, our medical myth buster too, all right here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRI, Public Radio International. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. That toll-free number again, 1-800-462-7413. But before our next call, recipe time again. This week we're in for quite a treat. Today we have a special guest chef joining in on the fun. Gail Gand is the author of the new cookbook, Lunch, which lays out delicious but simple lunch recipes for creating inspiring meals. She's a James Beard Award-winning chef who's appeared on Oprah and The Iron Chef, as well as being a dessert judge on Top Chef. And she joins us today to share with us her delicious recipe for Thai summer rolls. Gail, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me on, and I'm so excited about my new book. This is, I think, my eighth one. So, you know, I always feel like lunch is the neglected meal period. It's like the, you know, the stepchild of the three-meal period. It just doesn't get the attention it deserves, and I think lunch is the new dinner.
Now, you started working, you started doing this at a food cart at Lollapalooza in Chicago.
I did. Mm-hmm. You know, I work Lollapalooza every summer, which is a big music festival, three-day festival, and my family are all musicians, so my brother-in-law's bands are usually there, and he comes into town from New York for it. And I was just helping a farmer friend at his smoothie booth, and right next to the smoothie booth was a woman doing Thai summer rolls, and she was making them to order for thousands and thousands of people. And so she let me watch, and she showed me how to do it. And that's how I learned. And then I started teaching school children, doing it in cafeterias, doing it in my kids' cooking classes, and realized they're really transportable. They make a great fresh lunch, and they're easy to make.
That is perfect. So let's go through the recipe. Start out with a cup of shredded roasted chicken, half a cup of cucumber, and you cut them into sticks, long sticks, quarter.
Right. So everything's going to be kind of the same shape as the shredded chicken.
Mm-hmm.
Cucumber is going to be cut in 3-inch by 1/4-inch little sticks, mm-hmm. and then half a carrot peeled and grated. So again, you have sort of long strands.
These long strands. Cup of bib lettuce that is torn. Half cup of bean sprouts. 1/4 cup.
Again,
what kind of soy sauce do you use?
You know, I usually use the low sodium soy sauce, and I've talked to, you know, my Asian chef friends, and that's what they like as well. So we're using Kikkoman low sodium, so that's that green label.
2 tablespoonfuls of sesame oil. Freshly squeezed juice of 2 limes. Do not use reconstituted limes.
That's not going to deliver the acidity that you want and the brightness you want. And then 1/4 cup of honey. So I actually have you mix the soy sauce, the sesame oil, the lime juice, and the honey together to make like a little dressing.
Oh, it sounds wonderful. 4 rice paper sheets. Where do you get the rice paper sheets? Where do people get these?
We have a lot of grocery stores in Chicago, like Fresh Market and Fresh Farms, that are these international grocery stores. They're so fascinating. But also you could go to an Asian grocery store. They
and
would
they'll
have
that too.
Yeah,
1/4 cup of basil. You like Thai basil, or any basil would work. And 1/4 cup of fresh mint leaves.
Right. So we're using Thai basil leaves and mint leaves inside there.
So how do we make this? Instead of my reading the recipe, tell me what people do.
Super easy. So you're going to take a bowl, put that cup of shredded roasted chicken, the carrot that we grated, the cucumber that we cut into sticks, the bean sprouts, and the torn bib lettuce, and then just drizzle that dressing we made with the soy sauce, sesame oil, lime juice, and honey over the chicken and vegetables. Give it a quick toss, and that's going to be your filling. Then you're going to take your rice paper sheets. So what I do is I take a cake pan and put some warm water in it, and then I take a second cake pan, like a 9-inch, because it'll fit in that, and I turn it upside down, soak a tea towel or just any kind of towel in water and wring it out and put that over the cake pan. So that's kind of your stage where you're going to build your Thai summer roll. You soak the rice paper for like 30 seconds.
And that's critical. I think it's important to tell our listeners it is critical. If it's too long, it's not going to work. If it's too short, it's not going to work. It's the right amount of time that really makes a difference.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, count to 30, and what this means is do not answer the phone while you're making it. I have recipes you can answer the phone or recipes you can't, and
so,
those are the ones you don't.
So I have to tell you, last night I was making a rub, and I'm in the middle of putting this rub together because we're going to a wedding and we're going to make a chicken for 50 people at the wedding, but I want to bring the rub down to Florida with me. And the phone rings in the middle of measuring out what the brown sugar and the paprika that is going into the rub. And my wife Penny said, answer the phone. And I said, I'm not answering it. I'll lose track of how many tablespoonfuls I'm going to put in.
When I use salt, I always use kosher salt. And people are like, why do you keep kosher? And I am Jewish, but I don't keep kosher. I do it because I can see the salt. And when I get called away and I come back and look and try to remember if I added the salt, I can actually see it because those crystals are so big.
Oh, that's
interesting.
That's
why I use it. So anyway, we're going to fish that soaked rice paper out of the water, place it on that towel, mm-hmm. that damp towel you've got over the back of the other pan, and then lay a quarter of that filling just down the center like you would an egg roll. You're going to fold the ends in a little bit, you know, like an inch, and then just start rolling up. And you can put anything in it. I've done, you know, cut up tofu. I've done sautéed shrimp. And before you roll it, you're going to lay those leaves, a couple of the Thai basil leaves and a couple of the mint leaves. And
now,
that's it.
How do you keep it? When you're bringing it somewhere, do you put it in the, if you make it the night before, how does it keep?
I just roll them in plastic wrap. So I've got mm-hmm. them sort of, you know,
individuals.
They've got a little raincoat on, and then you can just plunk them in your lunchbox. So the idea of the book is to not only give you, you know, recipes you can do to entertain at home for lunch, but also things that are portable. So you might be packing these for your kids' lunch. You might be taking them to work for yourself, and you can make them the night before. They hold. So they're a great, you know, they can just be in the fridge. I've got them sitting there in my fridge when my son comes home after school. He grabs one of those as his snack.
It is a great recipe. I love the title of the cookbook, Lunch. And you're right, lunch is the new dinner. I'll have to use that as a phrase, like orange is the new black.
You know, and entertaining at lunchtime instead of dinner, it's so much easier because it's much shorter. People don't stay as long. They don't drink as much. They leave. You know, they go home. My family are all musicians, so aren't available at night. They all work and have, you know, sound check.
It sounds great. Thank you so much. Good luck with the book. Thanks so much, and keep up the good work.
Thank you. Thanks for
being on. You're welcome. Bye-bye.
To get a copy of today's recipe or to find out more about Gail Gann's latest cookbook, Lunch, visit our website at
ZorbaPastor.org. And while you're there, you can take a gander of what Tom looks like, what I look like. You can search for all your favorite recipes. It's a great website, ZorbaPastor.org. And don't forget, find us on Facebook.
1-800-462-7413 is our toll-free number, 800-462-7413. And a listener with us now, Zorba, in Spokane, Washington. Hi.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure. How can we help?
Okay. I have a numb finger that I have tingling down my arm that started right after I got a root canal surgery. And when I looked at the x-ray of the root canal that he put in, it seemed to really come close to the nerve, like almost touching it. And I know it sounds far-fetched, but is it possible that a root canal on the left side of my body could send nerve damage down to the right side of my body?
I don't think
so. On my arm.
I don't think so. Wouldn't make any sense. Also, a root canal, if we look at what's going on in our head, it's a nerve called the trigeminal nerve. And the trigeminal nerve, which is a cranial nerve, has incredible pain receptors. It's really the worst pain in the world that we get pretty much so, like in 9 out of 10 cases, are from the trigeminal nerve. Migraine headaches, pain in the eye, pain in the tooth, pain in the mouth. We have these tremendous pain receptors all around our head because our head is so important. You know, we've got major sense organs within our head, and then we've got our brain that is how we survive. So Mother Nature has put lots of sensory organs there to try to keep us from not doing the wrong thing. But if you have a root canal, I can't imagine how that would put numbness anywhere in the lower part of your body. Something else had to go on. Not the root canal, but something else had to happen to your body, and it was coincidental in time.
Well, so I accepted that the root, the nerves were not connected, even though they may join up at the neck, and that the neck is the source of making pain or numbness in your fingers. So I went to my doctor, and he prescribed prednisone without even looking into it. And I rejected that idea and thought, well, if it is a pinched nerve, what about doing some exercises, chiropractor, and mm-hmm. eating foods that have less inflammation? What are your thoughts on that part of it?
Well, sometimes chiropractic manipulation in the neck can make a difference. Massage therapy in the neck can make a difference. Neck traction, where you pull up on the neck because you might have a cervical disc. That's possible. Initially, you have to go to physical therapy to get the unit and learn how to do it. Can definitely make a difference. Yoga exercises for the neck can make a difference. So all those things, anything that kind of stretches out the discs in the neck or manipulates them can make a difference because you may have a disc that's actually pushing onto the nerve. So I certainly agree with you. That definitely is a possibility, and I think I would look in that area to see whether or not that was doing it, for sure.
And could a pinched nerve create permanent nerve damage?
Oh, sometimes. Oh, yes. Oh, absolutely. Pinched nerves can cause permanent damage. Most of the time, they don't. 99% of the time, they don't easily. But they certainly can cause nerve damage, and that's, of course, what you don't want to have. So I would look towards chiropractic manipulation or some sort of movement, something in that nature to help do this.
Okay. Thank you very much.
My pleasure. Take care.
We appreciate the call. And before the break, Zorba, time for another edition of Disagreeing with the Doc.
Wait, we need to have trumpets here or sounds.
No, you don't want trumpets when somebody's disagreeing with you.
I don't know. Disagreement's okay. That's the bread and butter of medicine.
We should get boo.
Oh, boo.
Boo,
that's right. Boo, that's right. Boo, boo, boo.
Disagree. Boo.
Boo, that's it.
Dr. Bob of Lancaster, Wisconsin, sent us an email regarding Zorba's recent column about HPV vaccinations. Here is an excerpt from his email. It truly bothers me when doctors exaggerate their claims to make a valid point. In the column about HPV vaccine, Dr. Pastor suggests that universal use of the vaccine would eliminate cervical cancer. As he undoubtedly knows, the vaccine protects against some of the most pathological of the HPV strains, but not all. So even the vaccinated have a finite risk of cancer and should continue to have a pap smear. Further, it's still unknown if elimination of those strains will result in more cancer being caused by less prevalent current strains taking over.
Well, he brings up an interesting point. So in this particular column for HPV, the point of the column was HPV injections for children are cancer. It's to prevent cancer. And who wouldn't want to have an injection to prevent cancer?
Sure.
If we had an injection that would get rid of a lot of lung cancer, we would do it.
Right.
If we look at the Zoster vaccine to prevent herpes Zoster, it's about 60 to 70% effective. We still recommend it. Same with really a lot of immunizations are 100%, but some are minimal, but this gets rid of a lot of cancer. So if you read the column carefully, which this physician may have done or not done, I said, could eliminate cancer in our lifetime. And the word could is a nice squishy word because it allows you to have
but
a little
does,
bit of
it. But it does assume that there's a possibility that all cancer could be removed at some point.
Right. And there was something else. There's something else that I put in the column that I think really was upsetting to a number of people.
Uh-huh.
There were a couple things. I said, if two virgins get married, the chances that she will get cervical cancer are zero.
Mm-hmm.
Or close to zero.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that may have been a misstatement. A male virgin and a female virgin get married because cervical cancer is a sexually transmitted disease, period.
Yeah, yeah.
So his point was you don't know where the other person was at the whole letter. In other words, you're sleeping with the sexual history of the previous person. That's not on this particular excerpt. But the other point was whenever I talk about sex, I always get emails.
Yeah, but that's not this.
But he's talking about the overstatement. Sometimes we do state, overstate to make a point. So I agree that he is correct.
Yeah, and he's right that they should continue to have pap smears.
Oh yes, I never said in the column, and never would say, don't get pap tests.
Yeah.
You have to continue having pap tests. However, I said there is a possibility that pap tests may disappear. But I think by the time that happens, I'll be far gone, 6 feet under.
We won't be around to talk about it.
No, or to have the police tell us, like the grammar police.
Do you disagree with the good doc? Send your complaints to
Zorba@WPR.org.
We have some interesting research to talk over. That's coming up next. More of your calls and our medical myth buster here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRI, Public Radio International. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. Our toll-free number is 1-800-462-7413. But before our next call, Zorba, it says here, house calls are making a comeback. How many of us actually remember doctors making house calls?
Oh, I remember house call when I was a kid. Dr. Erno would come over to the house and give me a shot of penicillin whenever I had a fever or anything. And the needle, it was at least a foot long. That's what I remember. And as soon as I saw the car stop in front of the house, I'm sure I started screaming because I remember my mother saying, coming upstairs and calming me down before the doctor got in the house.
Yeah.
Well, that's not the house call that we're seeing.
I don't believe in this headline. Doctors are not making house calls.
But we're talking about something very specific. We're talking about palliative care and post-hospital care, and we're talking about reimbursement from Medicare. Medicare's reimbursement and what this means and lack of reimbursement.
Okay.
So if you go in the hospital today for congestive heart failure, okay,
yeah,
and then you get back in the house, we release you from the hospital.
Right.
And a week later, 7 days later, you go back in for congestive heart failure. That hospital does not get paid.
That hospital is penalized.
It's penalized. It's not paid again.
Yeah.
So in other words, now they have an incentive to try to keep the person healthy when they leave the hospital versus coming in again and again and again,
uh-huh,
where they would get reimbursement. And the incentive is, let's start to improve our home care for patients on palliative care, for instance, who are at end of life and need to have palliative care, need to have painkillers, and let's look at people post-hospitalization. Those are the house calls that are being
made.
That's
interesting, but our system is not set up for that.
Well,
who are the people that are making
First of all, it's the Affordable Care Act that is actually motivated.
No, I know that, but I'm saying physically, there aren't doctors in the hospital who are used to running out.
I'll give you a good example.
Yeah.
Our group is now part of our hospital. We're one unit, and now basically if the hospital suffers, the group suffers, how do we make it better? This is a new methodology. Just like you set up an ICU and robotic surgery and new things, we have to develop ways to be able to get hospitals and nurses to be able to go there and do this.
Yeah, but your group is not used to doing this.
Well, but I'll tell you something. When you look at hospice, doctors and nurses and social workers make calls on home and hospice. We have to use the hospice model and then begin to apply it to the medical group and hospital model to be able to do this. But you're right. We're not used to doing this. So the question is, how do we do it? Well, that's what they're looking at. The other things they're looking at is they do an evaluation of the house for safety. They look at how the patient takes their pills. They look at whether or not other things are interfering with their care. And the motivation is money, money, money. If they go back in the hospital, it's going to cost the doctors in the hospital more money. Therefore, they better do a better job. And you know what? They're going to do it.
1-800-462-7413, our toll-free number. And to the phones now, Zorba, a listener in Wichita, Kansas. Hi.
Hi. Well, thank you very much for taking my call.
Sure. How can we help?
I was actually wanted to reference a recent call that where you were talking about e-cigarettes.
Mm-hmm.
And one of my questions that I haven't heard answered or been able to read answered is, when you blow out the mist, or whatever you blow out, does it contain nicotine?
Now, are you an e-cigarette smoker?
No, I'm not. I'm a real anti-smoker.
Uh-huh.
And in fact, when my daughter started to smoke and then wanted to stop, I went ahead and paid for e-cigarettes for her. But my question, I guess, is about secondhand smoke, because I'm starting to hear now that we have the e-cigarette and there's not all the tars and all that other stuff in the secondhand smoke, then perhaps it's going to be okay for smokers not to be smoking those everywhere.
Well, you bring up a really, really good point. A lot of e-cigarettes contain nicotine. That's how they get you to smoke them over and over and over again, because nicotine is addictive.
Yeah.
They have flavorings in them, too. They say, well, they're safe. They're not a tobacco product. And I say, the safest thing to inhale into your lungs is oxygen from the air without a pollutant. E-cigarettes are pollutants. They are air pollutants.
But after they suck it in and then...
I have no idea. I don't have any idea. I don't know if there's nicotine in the air.
Because
I have no idea.
Nicotine is... people are always so concentrated on the lungs. The nicotine
is not the pollutant in a cigarette that causes secondhand smoke. It's the combustion of the tobacco products and carbon monoxide that are doing it. Because when you have nicotine, there are nicotine inhalers that you can purchase that are prescription inhalers that help people quit smoking. And when they smoke it, I don't think there's any nicotine. There might be some. I'm not 100% sure. I'd have to Google it and find out that goes in the air. But let's look more broadly at e-cigarettes, okay? It's not just nicotine. There's stuff in there that people smoke that goes into the air that is a pollutant. Why is it a pollutant? It's stuff. Anything that goes in the air that's an industrialized product has the potential for being a pollutant. Now, the problem is the Clean Air Act, the people in the Clean Air Act in Washington haven't ringed and chimed in on this. The FDA tried to regulate it, and they lost in court. They lost the first battle in court. My hope is they'll get the second battle in court because they're trying to regulate it under tobacco, and the e-cigarette people who have lots of money, because some of these cigarettes are owned by tobacco companies, hint, hint, you know, have worked against it. When I talk about e-cigarettes, I get this tremendous pushback. I mean, there are people who are passionate about them, but there are people who also paid a lot of money to be passionate about them. And I'm concerned about them because they may encourage people to smoke and say, I can smoke these. But, and we don't know what it's going to do 20 years later.
But we don't know about secondhand smoke.
And we don't know about secondhand vapor, but I don't want it around me. I don't want to be in a restaurant next to somebody who's smoking e-cigarettes. And I don't want to have them in public spaces. I was in Washington, D.C. in the Museum of American History, and there was a person there in the lobby smoking an e-cigarette around children. And I wanted to go up, but I didn't do it, and I should have done it, but who likes to confront people and say, pardon me, could you take that possible cancer-causing stick and put it in your pocket? Mm-hmm. But I didn't do it, and I feel kind of bad that I didn't do it now, and I should have done it in a very nice way and say, I'm a doctor. I don't think this is right. So
well,
I agree
with you. That was my second comment, was that if this becomes more common now and people think, well, they can, now that it's not an actual cigarette, they can smoke it anywhere they want. What are children? What kind of role model is that?
Oh, absolutely. And have you
going to go back to cigarettes again?
Have you noticed the ads? The ads are saying, "Take back your space." In other words, the ads are saying you should be able to smoke where you want to on our e-cigarette. It's very interesting. Well, my thought is, I don't want you in my space. It's taken 30 years to pass good laws to basically get good, healthy air around our lungs. And that's made a huge difference in terms of health in this country. And I'm afraid that the e-cigarette people are pushing back into that space. And frankly, it's not a good idea. What you do at home is your business. That's your business. I don't want to interfere with that. That's your business. What you do in a public space is my business, too. Thank you.
I agree.
Thank you for calling. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you. We appreciate the call. And time now, Zorba, for our medical myth buster. Today's question comes from Derek of Eden Prairie, Minnesota. Hey, Doc. In a few weeks, some buddies and I are heading down to the Bahamas for some much-needed beach time. I've always heard it's a good idea to hit the tanning booth before a warm weather vacation and get a good base tan to prevent a nasty sunburn. But I have to say, lying in a tanning bed makes me feel like a gas station rotisserie chicken. Any truth to this claim, or is it half-baked?
Well, it is half-baked. Any tanning bed has a risk of causing cancer. That's it. Anytime you tan, it's a body's response to the sun, and it's trying to protect you against UVA and UVB rays. And the tanning people say, well, it doesn't burn as much. That is absolutely true. That is true. It does not burn because you don't have the rays, which I believe are more the UVB rays, that are more likely to make you burn. So when you get down there and you start, you may not have the same burn that you would ordinarily have. But frankly, you're still sitting in the sun. You're sitting in the bed. You're increasing the risk of cancer, squamous cell, basal cell, and, of course, the worst melanoma. So, yes, you may not burn, but you are increasing your risk of cancer in the long run. So I think it is a half-baked idea.
Yeah, and that's not why people use those tanning booths. They want to look good on
the beach. They want to look good. Absolutely, you're right. They want to look good on the beach. So what about spray-on stuff before you go? The spray look good on the beach.
Yeah, but that's phony.
That's phony, that's right.
Have a myth that may lack any tangible evidence? Just send it along in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
1-800-462-7413, toll free. Hubertus, Wisconsin joins now. Hi.
I have a question regarding disinfecting surfaces. When I travel, I tend to be a little bit of a germaphobe, and when I get to the room, the first thing I do is disinfect everything, the remote, the door handle, the little mini bar handle, all of that, and I usually use an antibacterial wipe for that, and then in the room, this is when I travel to, say, the Dominican or Mexico, in the room, they recommend you use the bottled water to brush your teeth. Which I do, but what I also do at the end is I rinse my toothbrush in the with the faucet, but then I do a final rinse in a little cup of vodka. And I'm wondering if that if vodka truly does disinfect the toothbrush.
Uh-huh. Well, vodka would do it because it's got alcohol in it. But before we go to the germaphobe of the disinfectant, so we'll talk about that.
Yeah.
When you brush your teeth, you should not, you know, don't do it in the sink and don't wash it out in the sink. Wash it out with bottled water. You should do that. I wouldn't wash it out in the sink.
Okay.
Yeah, use bottled, you know, it'll cost you an extra couple of bucks and use bottled water to wash it off and then you're fine. You don't have to disinfect the toothbrush at all. I would just use bottled water to rinse your mouth and then I would, you know, turn up the bottled water, squirt it out, and use it for the toothbrush.
But then you don't get the vodka.
Then you don't get the vodka, Tom. It's on the vodka, that's right. And then have the shot of vodka. Then drink the shot of vodka and go to bed. That's one. That's one. But I wouldn't bother disinfecting it with vodka. I would just use the right water. Water's really the issue, you know, when you're traveling. So I would do that. That would be a better way to do it. I want to get into the disinfectant thing. Mm-hmm. Now, it may make you feel better, but in fact, it really doesn't make a difference. Now, forget the Dominican Republic for just a minute. Germs that are on the doorknobs and on the handles that are all around us all the time do not make a difference in terms of our health and wellness. In a hotel, when you walk in there, the toilet has been washed, things have been washed, it doesn't make a difference. If you feel better, and it makes you feel good so that you can be comfortable, by all means do it, but you're not going to make a difference in your health. There's no data that really makes a difference at all. So I just want to tell you, you feel better, but it doesn't matter. You know, a regular cleaning of a room in a nice hotel, I mean, I assume that you're going to a hotel that is not a $29.95 hotel, right?
Correct.
Right. So you've got a nice hotel. They put it in. They wash the bathroom. It's not going to make a difference. You know, you have your hands on the door all the time. They're just around here. And our body does a good job. And there's evidence that we actually – it's okay for us to come into contact with these bacteria because we then develop antibodies. So there's really good evidence for this. Now, water is a different issue when you're traveling. But I have a question. How can you travel outside of the U.S., Canada, or Europe if you're a germaphobe? Because there's so many germs when you go to a developing country like the Dominican Republic. How do you do that?
I don't know. I do, and I do very well. I've never gotten sick.
Yeah, but how do you like it? You're looking around here, and it's not a germ-free environment. They live around germs all the time.
I'm not quite that bad.
Okay.
I'm not quite that bad. I just like to have everything clean.
When I first arrive,
I just want everything clean, and then the remainder of the germs that come into the room are
you don't concentrate.
Those are my germs.
So when you're traveling though in a third world country like the Dominican Republic or Mexico, they have different standards. We know that. Mm-hmm. If you want to do it there, I think that's okay. You know, because you really don't know how the room is going to be cleaned unless you go to an expensive hotel, in which case it should be looked at.
I've never been sick, knock on wood. I've never been sick. I've been lucky.
Okay. Keep it up. And if you get sick, it's Cipro. Just make sure you have some Cipro and antibiotic with you and some Imodium.
Yes, I do. Definitely take that along.
There we go. So thank you so much for your call.
Thank you so much.
Mm-hmm.
Bye-bye.
Before we head out today, Zorba, we love our listeners here at Zorba Pastor on Your Health, and we're always happy to hear from the grammar police, the pronunciation police, even the sewer police have chimed in. But how about the mushroom mob.
Oh, gosh. The mushroom mob? Frightening.
Let's take an email from a listener, Paul, who in all honesty sounds like a real fun guy. Get it? Mushroom?
Got it.
Fun guy?
Got it.
He writes, "Dear Zorba, on a recent program, you mentioned the term shrooms with a subtle remark that it may have been a counterculture term and therefore best avoided. Your suspicions are correct. Shroom was a slang term for mushrooms that contain psilocybin, a mild hallucinogenic alkaloid found in some toadstools. They are certainly not for everyone because a large percentage of the population does not consider hallucinations to be a pleasurable experience. The main problem The main problem with this issue is the lack of adequate education and training in correctly identifying non-poisonous mushrooms. As you know, many mushrooms are poisonous."
Yes, and I don't think psilocybin mushrooms grow in the Midwest. I've never heard of anyone getting And by the way, it is not really a mild hallucinogen. It is an hallucinogen. I mean, it's mescaline, psilocybin, LSD, pretty much all, you know, the same in terms of what they do. And you would not want that in your omelet or on your salad.
You know all this from medical research.
Totally.
Not
it's from medical research. You know, I smoked, but I didn't inhale.
If you take issue with something Zorba said, send your grievances along in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org. Being a child of the 60s, I can just relate to the information.
If you missed anything during the show or just want to download our show podcast, visit us on the web
at ZorbaPastor.org, or we are all over Facebook.
And of course, you can call us anytime at 800-462-7413. Zorba Pastor on Your Health is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's not intended as a medical diagnosis, so please do check with your doc. Our executive producer is Carl Christensen, and our technical director is Brad Kohlberg. Our theme music is by Leo and Ben Sidran. For Zorba Pastor, I'm Tom Clark, hoping you'll be with us for the next Zorba Pastor on Your Health.
Copies of today's show are available through the radio store at 800-747-7444, ask for program number 0510Z. More information on Zorba, his clinic, and healthy living, including heart-healthy recipes, podcasts, and show archives, is available online at zorbapastor.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.